G'day, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohn.
I'm Peter Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a couple of hot topics to discuss, and one of them may in fact roll into a number of other topics. So we hope you'll bear with us on that one. We have our special guest as always, and today it's Kookaburra's coach Colin Batch, as the Kookaburra is about to embark on the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup, and that will be Colin Batch's first major tournament in charge of the Kookaburras. But anyway, plenty to talk about on the show. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And John, I believe you've given me the honours of starting this time around.
Take it away, mate.
Well, there's a couple of things that have come up, and it's more actually thoughts that have come from other people, in that I've spoken to three coaches from national teams and local teams in the last week, and all of them have turned to me because they know I work on television and in the media, and they've said, when will the TV stations stop persisting with the interviews of players coming off at half time or with coaches at half time? Now, it is something personally I never felt comfortable with, and I've had to carry out those interviews at numerous events around the world. I don't like it, and I remember when Ricky Herbert was the coach of Wellington Phoenix, he came up to me one day when I was working for Fox and said, "You don't agree with those interviews, do you?" And I was very cautious with my reply, and I said, "Why do you say that?" And he goes, "Because you asked the shortest two questions anyone has ever asked." He goes, "Because you knew I wanted them in the dressing room." And that is the thing, is I think we have to realise, do we get any information out of these players really in those interviews? And watching at the weekend, having had those three conversations in the past week, I listened a little bit more intently, and the players say absolutely nothing. In fact, in some cases, the person asking the question says more than the person answering the question, the player answering the question. So I'm not sure. And I mean, one of the coaches said to me, he goes, "Look, do you seriously think I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do?" He goes, "Because they've probably got somebody sitting somewhere that's listening to what I'm going to say, and they will then relay that message to the coach going, this is what they're looking to do so that you can negate it." He goes, "There's no way on television," he goes, "during a game, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do with the team." He goes, "Give me a break." He said, "Do you think I was born yesterday?" So I don't see the merit in this whatsoever. I think it is something that it's no longer giving the viewer any insights or any real experiences to what's going on in the game, so I drop it personally.
Well, Ashley, I think that, you know, if I concentrate on my processes, I might possibly be able to come out and answer this question in the second half.
I mean, honestly, whatever.
I don't understand it either. And I'm sure from the coaching perspective, it must be so difficult if you do want to get people in. And guys do recovery stuff at halftime as well. I don't really enjoy them. I don't think you get anything extra out of them.
Well, I'm going to put on the website a poll. So when this podcast goes up, we're going to put a poll with it just to see what your views are. And we would love you to vote on that so that we can maybe on the next podcast tell you what the outcome of that poll is. Now, just connected to that, John, I got another email from a gentleman called Sean. And I've emailed Sean back because I think he wanted me to publish his letter on the website, but he got a little bit personal about a few people in the media, and I was very concerned about getting sued if I wrote his thoughts or his feelings up there.
You could send them to me though, Sean.
Now, it's a very awkward one for me because obviously I do work in the media and I don't like knocking other people that work in the same field as me. But what he was saying and the point he was making, he said the thing he's getting sick and tired of seeing is people from print media being used on television to now be the experts. And he said it's abundantly clear what is happening, and it's happening obviously with the Murdoch-owned or News Limited type setups, in that on Fox Sports they're using journalists from their newspapers presumably to cross promote so that they can promote the newspapers. But he's, and I did take some of his words here, and he goes, They are wooden. They are awful. Some of them are incredibly vain. And he had a go at two people from the world of football. So I'm presuming Sean must be a football person because he was having a go at Tom Smithies and Dave Davidovic. And, you know, I think he's got a point. I do think there is a time and a place. We have it on the radio, and I think radio is slightly different because some print journalists are terrible on radio, and equally some television journalists couldn't write a match report if their life depended on it. So I think there are reasons that some of these people are in the spheres they're in, and maybe, just maybe, they should stick to those and concentrate on the field that they are in and not try and cross over. And I'll give you just another example here, in that, as you know, we offer the streaming service, and we were trying to dovetail with one of the paper newspapers or media outlets here in WA, and we progressed to a very long way with this particular company. And then the sports editor said at the final meeting, when we were going through all the budgeting, what's my role going to be in it? And I said, well, do you commentate? No. I said, well, then I don't think you have a role in it. He goes, no, but I'm the sports editor, so I think it could be a really good vehicle to make people in Perth more aware as to who I am and my role within the organisation. And to me, that is a major problem. If you're a sports editor, it's not about you, mate. It's about the product that you're putting out there. And it should be that the stories that your journalists are putting together, the stories that you as a media outlet are putting together, it's not about you personally. And this is where I think some people get it horribly wrong. It is not an ego-driven industry. If you want to be front and central, go into television and try and get a role as a presenter. But if you journalism is your bent, and that's what you studied, and presumably when you did that, you wanted to tell stories, then I think you have to look at that a little bit closer.
Oh, all fair comments. I would say this to Sean. It is an ever-changing landscape, and it's a very quickly changing landscape. And one of the areas that has struggled a lot is the area of what we would traditionally call print media, newspapers, okay? Newspapers will be dead soon. They will die. You just won't be able to buy a newspaper because, you know, why print it? It will be the bottom line for all companies. Why have the expenditure?
I think you may be right. I don't think you'll be totally right, because I think some newspapers, not necessarily in Australia, have been smart and worked out how and what you put in a newspaper. I don't think the Australian newspaper landscape has actually worked that out yet, and they struggle with what goes online and what they actually print. Whereas if you look at other countries around the world, they've been smart. What goes online is literally just press release, bang, get the news out there so that people know we've got it. But then they can do in-depth reporting in their newspapers, which isn't online, and therefore there is a reason to buy a newspaper.
Well, yeah, I think News Limited's followed that in a small way with The Australian, because in their print edition you get everything, but online you need to pay a subscription to get the opinion pieces, you know, the ones I like to read as opposed to what I can read online. But there's that, given that there might be a newspaper or two, the general world will not, people will not be taking news from a newspaper. They'll be getting it online. That's where people are going to get their news from in the future. And journalists are trying to find a way to fit into that online world, especially when you look at what's being presented to us as journalism online is in fact not journalism online. As you just said, it's press releases online. And stories that are appearing online as news are not news. They're gossip at best, or they're an advertisement.
Well, you've hit the nail on the head there. And if you look at, and if you follow any of the media and all the people that have been made redundant, the true journalists that could write stories who've had experience in the field have all lost their jobs, or a great number of them in Australia have lost their jobs. Yeah. And the problem there is because they can get cheaper labour from someone straight out of university to literally type up, as we said, a press release and make it sound like it's actually a story. Now, the other thing, going back to the argument that I've got, this is another reason why they're using the print journalists on television and possibly in radio stations that they own, is it's a cost saving, because when these guys go on the television, they don't have to pay an appearance fee to them. Whereas if they did get an expert, say a former international player, to come and give their opinions, they have to pay them. And so again, it is a cost-saving measure. But all I wonder is, are the viewers getting, as Sean was alluding to, are they getting value for their subscription to a TV station like Fox, because they're suddenly getting something that's probably rehashed from something they read online rather than another view of a situation in sport?
Now, just while we're online, talking online, I was quite shocked on Monday morning when I woke up. Now, I'm not sure when you might happen to hear this podcast, but the night before, the Sunday evening before, Perth Glory had beaten Melbourne City, 2-0 in a semi-final that no one gave them a hope for, except for the odd bods like us over here in Perth and Glory supporters. No one. You listen to the national football press, and that they thought it was a done deal. You know, Timmy Carr was going to do something, and it would all be over. Monday morning, I'm trolling for the news of this result. I knew what the result was. I'd seen the bit of the game on TV, but I wanted to see the press about it. I wanted to read the reactions and all those sorts of things. Perth Now website. Log on to Perth Now. I think the key feature of the Perth Now website is in its name, Perth, and that would fit in with Perth Glory. What's the first featured sports story about football? Champions League results. Go to the West Australian. This is the West Australian. What's their lead football story on their homepage? Champions League results. What are you people doing? Who do you really work for? And I think that's one of the problems that we're coming to. It's almost like this centralised news system.
It's syndicated news, isn't it? I mean, we've discussed this on the show before.
Absolute rubbish from both organisations. And the same for the ABC as well. You had nothing up there as well.
Well, Scott Miller, the former Glory left-back, you know, he went onto Twitter and he was having a go at the West Australian, saying, for crying out loud, you know, this is a big result. They're now through to the semi-final against Sydney FC. You know, why was it not featured in the paper on the back page ahead of AFL when you look at the results that the two teams had? Well, nothing special, really. I mean, the Eagles went down and the Dockers, okay, won again, but you know, he's saying this was a big result for the Glory. It's finals football. They deserve to be on the back page. And I think he has an absolute point. And it's just got
definitely
ridiculous.
Oh, at least maybe you could have had a text story about at the bottom. And the West used to do that, split stories. They'd have a photo story and then they'd have a text story on the back instead of this whole one story back page that they seem to love to do these days.
They've got to fatten out the paper somehow because nobody else is buying it as it gets more anorexic every month.
It seems to, doesn't it? Well, that's it. That's what's happening to the newspapers, and that's not the West necessarily, and it's the way it is. But
well, it's interesting though, John, again, because if you look at that, in London you've got the Evening Standard, which was losing money hand over fist. It was a paper that came out in London every afternoon. The interesting thing is now it is turning a profit, and what they did was they made it a free newspaper. So they just suddenly went, and the circulation, as I think the last time I read an article about it, is trebled from what they used to actually when it was going for sale. So, and it is worth picking up and reading because it actually
doesn't cost you anything.
No, but it is actually worth having it because the stories in there are good. And the interesting thing I find, and we've discussed this again about, when you're in India, if you read the reports, they write cricket reports as they were written yesteryear, where they describe the ball skimming across the grass, you know, to the boundary and bouncing back. And it's so much more descriptive writing, which I actually enjoy. I mean, it drives me mad when you read a match report these days and it goes, so-and-so beat so-and-so, the coach said this, and then it's just the teams. I want to find out how the goals were scored. Did the guy beat two defenders and cross it from the right and it was a diving header at the near post? I don't just want he scored a header to make it 1-0. Well, where did he score the header? Was it in the middle of the goal? Was it low down? Was it high up? there's no explanation, so you can't visualise it. And just on that topic, we should actually slag my team in England who got relegated. Swindon Town, who lost against Scunthorpe United, in their club match report didn't even write that they were relegated in that game. They wrote the match report, no mention of the fact that we'd got relegated. And so they've been the laughing stock across the UK for 48 hours, saying, talk about being in denial.
Well, yeah, I can understand why they might choose to not say that, because there's plenty of other outlets that would be imparting that news to and information to people. Yeah,
come on, you can't, John, they should still accept the facts.
They should accept it, but I can understand why the bloke who's doing that press report's just going, no, I can't bring myself to do it. I just can't bring myself to write it. I understand.
Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me. Ich liebe dich. Hit me, hit me, hit me. Hit me with your rhythm stick. Hit me slowly.
Well, yes, it is now time to turn our attention to our guest on this podcast, and we are talking hockey, because Colin Batch is the new coach of the Kookaburras. He's coached them in a series against Pakistan, where the Kookaburras were victorious up in Darwin, but this will be his first real test as the Kookaburras head off to Malaysia to take part in the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup. It's going to be an interesting tournament. Great Britain are there, India are there, New Zealand, Japan and Malaysia, and many of the teams rebuilding after the Olympic Games, so you're seeing a lot of new faces in many of those teams. India giving four debuts to players in their team from the players that won the Junior World Cup. Great Britain also has three or four players, I think it is, that have only played four games so far for their country. And of course, the Kookaburras have a few players that have less than 10 caps as well. But thought it'd be interesting to catch up with Colin Batch and see how the team is progressing and what style of play we can expect. Colin Batch, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks, Ashley.
Well, first of all, how does it feel to be back in Australia? It's been 8 years, I think, since you were involved with the hockey program here.
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes. I'm really enjoying it so far. Very challenging, for sure. There's been significant changes at a Hockey Australia level, but also within the high-performance program. So, yeah, it's different, for sure. Enjoying working with the group of players that are there at the moment.
Last time you were assistant coach to Barry Dancer, Was it an easy decision to come back and be head coach?
Well, it was tough in this respect that I'd already signed on for New Zealand, so I didn't like breaking that contract, but it was an opportunity to come back and coach, the Australian team, and I've still got my children here. I'm used to Perth and all those things, so there were a lot of positives, and of course the quality of players that I'm working with here now in Perth and around Australia is something that I wouldn't say I've been striving for, but it's a natural progression that you do at some stage want to coach your national team, and I was given the opportunity. So yeah, from that point of view, it wasn't a hard decision, and then I had to consider my wife's career as well, so that's all comes into it. So yeah.
Obviously, we've seen an evolving with Rick Charlesworth, and Graham Reid took over. He'd been his assistant to Rick, and so there was a sort of style of play that they adapted. Are you going to do that, or are we going to see a gradual evolvement to the way you want the team to play?
Yeah, look, the program's been pretty successful over the last 8 years. The only thing missing has been the Olympic gold, and we know that that's not easy to obtain. As far as what sort of style we'll play, we've made some changes on field at the moment. We're still evolving how we will play. Australia have been pretty successful with a high press, a high energy, high intensity type of game. I want to see us play a little bit different at the start, and then decide where that best fits and against what opposition how we need to play. So we know sometimes in really hot weather we can't play that high energy game. It is sapping. It's an energy thing that you it really takes it out of you. And we want to be at our best during finals, whether that's quarterfinals, semifinals, or the gold medal match. We want to play at our best. So it's aiming for that in every tournament.
I'm sure there's going to be criticism because when you're a head coach, there always is, isn't there? But are you expecting people to say, well, where is that attacking Australian traditional hockey going? Or are you looking more, this is about results, and as you touched on there, winning Olympic gold?
Yeah, look, it's hard to be in the sporting industry these days and be successful and entertaining at the same time. You see lots of different sports, you know. I think, you know, if we look at AFL, Hawthorn were very successful and, you know, it was a predictable way of playing, but a very successful way. And all of a sudden you saw some teams emerge that everyone jumped on the bandwagon and said, oh, that's a great way of playing. But at the end of the day, we're in the business of being successful. So, you know, I don't know where we'll be. It's for others to judge, I suppose. But, you know, we want to ultimately have success in Tokyo. So that's what we're trying to achieve. And the decisions we make at the moment are based around being successful in Tokyo.
There's obviously a lot of new faces coming into the Kookaburra squad, people that only got sort of a few games at the end of last year. Are you excited by the talent that is coming through?
Yeah, and we're by no means finished. You know, we think we've got another group of players coming from underneath. Our network coaches are doing a very good job in developing them, and we want to empower them to make sure that they're coaching the way we believe needs to happen so that they're successful at the higher level. So, you know, in 18 months' time, it might be a totally different group. We're not sure yet, but at the moment, we're working with quite a number of new players. You know, they've had, if you have a look at the number of games that are played by the Kookaburras, we've only got a handful that have played a lot of games, and there's a lot of new ones there. So they haven't had a lot of experience at international level, but they've had a lot of experience around the Australian program. So I'm hoping that you know, some of the good things and good qualities that they have learnt over the years will hold them in good stead.
You mentioned obviously there was a lot of experience there before. Some of those players have been let go now, or sort of have been pushed to one side to give the youth a chance. Is there a possible way back for some of those, or do you feel that they've had their time and it is now the next generation?
Well, at the moment, it's the next generation. You know, we're not. Some of the players that we've left out have certainly indicated that they want to continue, and you know, are looking at opportunities. Some need to get injury clearances and all those sorts of things. But you know, we're working hard with the players we've got. They're responding really well. They're a good group. They're very coachable. So, you know, my aim at the moment is to make sure that they continue to improve, and you know, if we can develop more depth in the group through that way, we know what perhaps some of the other players can come back, but that's for the future.
The one thing I always feel is there is so much focus on this four-year Olympic cycle. Do you feel coming in that there's maybe too much expectation, too much emphasis, or is that the way it has to be?
Well, I guess that's the way it has to be, and you know, people judge our success in 4 years or 3.5 years' time, whether we've done well at the Olympics or not. That's just, I guess, you know, in the Australian sporting landscape, everyone, you know, just assumes that we're going to be successful at everything. I hope that that's the case for the Kookaburras in Tokyo, but you know, it's just the way it is. We're very competitive. We want to succeed. You know, that's international sport at the moment, and certainly in men's hockey, the depth around the world is pretty strong. The sport's in a good place, I think.
The one thing I've always noticed about you, Colin, I've never seen you lose your cool. Do you ever lose your cool as a coach?
Oh, yeah. Probably not publicly, but yeah, I certainly do. And, you know, I'm trying to get the best out of the players for any given minute. And, you know, if we've been trialling something, we know that there's going to be errors in trialling new things. So I'm patient and want clarity with the playing group to make sure they understand what we're doing. But I also want the players to drive the high intensity and the level of performance. So if that's not happening for whatever reason, then we've got slack, then yeah, the players will certainly know about it.
In that situation, is it you talking to them, or is your door open for them to come if they don't understand or they're struggling to get to grips with what you're trying to make them do?
Yeah, we're trying to have a two-way conversation, that's for sure. We the coaching staff will be bringing certain things to the playing group, but we want them likewise to bring to us, you know, why can't we do X, Y and Z, and whatever it is. And we'll talk through that and discuss it. And I think if we've got that sort of culture within the group, it's going to be a successful group.
You're just about to head off for the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup. Last time you were there with New Zealand, you've won it with New Zealand. Is it going to be a bit odd playing against them?
Well, I experienced that when I first coached in Belgium, and you know, the first time against Australia was a bit strange, I must admit. It'll be like that with Australia and New Zealand, and in actual fact the first game we play in Aslan Shah is against New Zealand. So look, I've had a lot to do with that program, obviously. I know the coaching staff very, very well, and you know, it's like it happens in international sports. Suddenly you know, you're working with one program, you take a 180-degree turn, and you know, now you're coaching against them. So I do know a lot about the program. It'll be challenging. But there's no doubting that you know what I want to happen in that match, and that is for Australia to win.
You certainly look as if you're enjoying everything at the moment. Let's hope it continues that way.
Yeah, thanks, Ashley. Really, I am enjoying it. We've got a good coaching staff, I believe, and a good playing group. So hopefully we'll get some good results over the next 12 to 18 months.
Well, thanks again for your time, Colin.
Thanks, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Chris Cirillo from the Kookaburras, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Chris is one of those players who is not part of the squad anymore.
There's a few of them.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them, as Colin alluded to there, the older players who've been basically pushed to one side. And again, John, we've had this conversation off air. I sort of feel that there is, and I mentioned it there with Colin Batch. Is it right to be working in four-year cycles that we go, okay, the Olympics? I think by all means have the Olympics in your sights down the track. But I think there's a few of those players that the Sorellos, Orchards, just throwing those two names up because they're the first two that came into my head, but that may have benefited the team by taking us through to the Commonwealth Games maybe and having those younger players that are coming through play alongside them for a little bit. Again, it's a coach's call, but I'm just saying, in my book, I think sometimes this four-year cycle is too far ahead because, as we know, sport can change, a player can get an injury, it can change overnight.
I'm not sure how these players' contracts work when you're dealing with people who are essentially working as public servants, if you like. I mean, they're being paid by the government. So I'm not sure how their contract system works. But it seems that they've got far less security than what a sportsman has outside of that system.
In a privately owned club.
Yeah, or, yes, basically. Or in a privately owned competition, if you like. I'm not sure if that's particularly true, but it appears that there's far more protection for those players who are playing rugby union or rugby league, for example, than there are playing the government-funded sports. And that's swimming and athletics and hockey and those sorts of sports that don't have the big bucks behind them and that go to the Olympics. Traditionally go to the Olympics.
But of course, if Colin Batch gets it right and the players perform and they do manage to win gold at the next Olympics in Tokyo, then he's got it absolutely spot on. But that's the thing, is there's always different opinions in sport.
Yeah, I just think it's difficult for those players involved with the lack of security and no real way to plan for the future. And not that the planning for the future is hard enough for a sportsman when they're getting paid $1 million a year. Okay, they don't know that, like you say, they could get injured. Form is a very temporary thing. But I think as well in hockey, there's always been, because it's been an amateur sport, money hasn't generally been a question. It's only recently that it's seriously become a question and a major one. That in hockey, that's always happened. Those sorts of selection policies have always been in place, you know. And guys who found themselves on the outer after one Olympics have very often found themselves playing in the next Olympics. It's the way they seem to run there. It's trying to generate as large a pool of players as possible with the experience needed to pick from. And so I wouldn't write either of those guys off or anybody else that's been dropped necessarily if they choose to keep working at it and they can have that as a goal. There's no reason they can't get there.
Now, and just looking at the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup, first game for Australia is against Colin Batch's old team, New Zealand, the Black Sticks, and that is at 6:05 on Saturday. I think it will be shown on Fox, and I'm pleased to say that I've been allocated that game to do the commentary, so looking forward to that immensely.
Oh, good. I'll try and catch a bit of that. Is that on Fox, did you say?
I think it is being picked up by Fox. I'm not 100% sure.
Okay, well, I might have to find that information out and stick it up on your webpage. Now, my turn, which could go on for a while and ramble in lots of different directions, but it's going to start with netball. Now, a few weeks ago we mentioned on this show, we talked about, you know, what women's sport and some of the hurdles it was going to have to face if it was really truly to grow and become, you know, the equivalent of men's sport. Well, not that people think it may or may not be able to do that, but you know, what pass it has to take. And recently we've seen a bit of a hiccup with netball. Now, netball's in a situation where the competition's split between clubs owned by state bodies and clubs owned by private institutions. And those institutions happen to be football clubs, male football clubs, that also happen to run female football teams. Now, I'm not fully across the reasons why netball players threatened to strike. At the outside, from the outside, it appears as though their sole reason was because their preferred candidate wasn't elected to the board. The threat was, if you don't elect this particular person, then we're going to go on strike because we want them on the board. They're the player's friend. Which, from my perspective, says, so what you're saying is everybody else who's on the board is not the player's friend, that you see that the board is not supporting the players. And it was appeared as if this whole conversation was running around the threat that their players would have to give back some of the concessions that had been made towards their pay demands with the last pay deal. Roll it back. Now, the reasons why they would want to roll it back is perhaps because the money's not there, and the money was never there. And the netball players have got to take a look and around at the sporting landscape as it stands and have a look at where they sit in it and where other sports sit in it. Now, just this morning, a report came out saying that Channel 9 loses $40 million a year on its cricket coverage. That is the flagship coverage that Channel 9 has, the cricket. That is the toppest show that they have on their station. It loses them $40 million a year. Now, the netball girls should have a real close, hard look at that when they consider exactly what pay and conditions they are prepared to play for. Now, do you want to be paid more or less money? Do you want free-to-air coverage? Because they've got great free-to-air coverage, mate. Weekends, they've got games in the middle of the day, prime-time spots for sitting back on the couch and having an afternoon cup of tea and a toasted sandwich and watching some sports. So they've got some good things going for them. But the bottom line is that the Australian sports landscape is not a pit of money, and we're seeing how that's affecting other sports as well. We have come to that crossroads where the athletes are now going to have to reassess the position that they've taken over their pay and conditions. And do you really want your sport to move forward, or do you want it to stagnate here now and drop away?
I think you've hit this. There's about three or four points there. The first one I'm going to say is, I think you have to look at why did these AFL clubs get involved in netball, and why have they launched the Women's League in the first place? And the reason is because now a lot of funding and a lot of things, people want sport to be all inclusive, because this is where soccer, and I'll call it that just to differentiate the two sports, is murdering all the other sports, because their female participation figures are through the roof by comparison to other sports. And that was in a recent report that came out. So they have that, men and women playing it pretty much on an equal level, although on the pay side we know again there is a huge differential. So that was one of the reasons why I think they've got in, is to try and grow that female audience. Because when it comes to a TV deal and they break it down, the TV companies, when they go out to the advertisers, want to see who the demographic is. And if they don't have those female fans watching the game, then suddenly your marketing or advertising possibilities shrink, because obviously they don't have the women's market that they can pitch their advertising to. The other thing you touch on there is the netball. We always said it would be in trouble if it went with the AFL clubs. I think, again, I'm finding it very difficult. If I wasn't on the mailing list for the West Coast Fever, I think I'd find it very hard to find out what was going on in the league. I think the coverage to me has been the worst I've known it, even when it was the Commonwealth Bank series, and that was just an Australian competition before it went to the ANZ Championship. To me, those two, it was easier to find information than it is at the moment. So I think the coverage of it has been pretty, it's dropped off a long, long way, because I'm finding it hard to keep tabs on what is going on. That might be just me, but that's how I feel about it at the moment. It's just not getting the coverage that it used to. Going back to, again, the Channel 9 situation, John, we've been saying this again. There had to be a point where the bubble burst. You cannot continually be throwing money at sport on TV without getting money back in. And obviously Channel 9, it is their flagship thing. They wanted it. They paid the big bucks. I think they've made some big mistakes, though, in that some of their commentators now, and again, I hate to sort of knock other people in the thing, but they brought in, and there was a brilliant article written recently, that some of the best commentators are not ex-players, and yet some of the best commentators that are good are not necessarily ex-test players. I mean, some of the test players that Channel 9 have got on there are just boring. I think there's no other way of putting it. Some of them are outstanding. But I mean, if you look at, you know, Richie Benno was brilliant. Mark Nicholas, there's some people like him, some people don't. Never played test cricket, but is a good presenter. And I just think they've got some of the wrong people. It's become a bit of a mates club, and that's turned a lot of cricket fans off. As we know, a lot of people will watch the cricket with the radio on and the TV vision. So that's happening. But the other thing is, if you look at the FFA, they cannot give the football away at the moment. They're struggling to find a free-to-air broadcaster that will take the A-League. So again, it's showing that people, sport can't bring in the dollars, or the money that the sporting bodies want is just unrealistic now as the economy begins to shrink. And the other concern that you have about the board members, I have concerns about the boards in sport. If you look at the AIU, that is a mess. You look at the FFA, that is a mess. You look at the Australian Olympic Committee, that is a mess. And we could go through many more sports, and I just think the people are on the boards for the wrong reasons. They're no longer there for the sport. They're there for their own CVs, the doors it opens for them, the free tickets to sporting events and the caviar and, you know, salmon sandwiches they get when they go to those events. They are not in the main there for the sport. And if you look at what's happening in netball, I think that you're seeing somebody trying to be parachuted in there that is not from the world of netball and who doesn't necessarily have the soul of the game in their heart.
If I was in the netball community or part of that on the board, I'd be looking very closely at what's happened to rugby union, because what you're seeing now is a situation where the Melbourne Rebels are not going to be cut. And they're not going to be cut because they're privately owned. And it will cost the ARU a fortune. Now, some number thrown around about $4 million. It wouldn't surprise me if it goes way beyond that. I mean, and that's...
Well, that's the owner wants that compensation. But then, of course, you may have the players' contracts that have to be paid out on top
absolutely.
Of that. So, as you say, yeah, the price will blow out.
And okay, so they're essentially having one private owner... dictate what the actions of the governing body are going to be, because of it just the financials of it just don't make sense to kick them out. So this guy basically is going to tell the ARU what they can and can't do.
But I just don't understand why, you know, you've got five Australian teams at the moment, we're going to sacrifice one of those for a Japanese team. That just and the Japanese team is losing money hand over fist because it plays three games in Singapore, and people in Singapore, and I got this from somebody in Japan saying they don't care about it. Singapore, nobody really cares about rugby. That's why they can't fill the stadium. It costs them a fortune to do that. In fact, the commentator is paying his own airfare from Japan to go and commentate on the game because they don't have the money to cover his cost.
Well, You got to be careful when you invite Japan to be part of something in Southeast Asia, and this might sound terribly, terribly insensitive, but Japan isn't exactly popular in Southeast Asia still. I know it's 60 years, but, you know, there's some still deep resentments run through Southeast Asia about the Japanese. I've seen it firsthand, and it does exist, and it's no surprise that Singaporeans don't turn out to watch a Japanese football team go around.
No, I think you've got a point there, but it's going to be interesting. I think Australian sport in the next 4 years, we're going to see a lot of radical change.
Well, you know, you're also talking about the three football club-owned netball teams are in direct competition with their three AFL women's teams. And when push comes to shove, you know what's going to get shoved. And it's just a tricky situation for the... I never agreed with the expansion of the league and the changing of it as it was. I can imagine that the previous championship involving New Zealand was probably a financial drain. That would be obvious one reason why they'd want to get rid of it. But I think the restructure has totally missed the point. Netball was... the strength of it was the grassroots. It was the connection between the clubs through their state bodies with the juniors and all that. When you start imposing teams on people, they tend not to necessarily like it that much. Although the Collingwood side, it must be said, have lucky that they've got the huge Collingwood machine behind them at the moment. But how long do the fans stick around for? I'm not so sure.
Yeah, well, we'll have to wait and see on that one. We've not felt confident about it ever since it was announced.
Look, and I wish the girls well. I hope that they can get what they want, but I think they've just got to take a good, close, hard look at it and understand the dynamics of the situation as it is. Go!
Now, we haven't had a gold for a while, but I just wanted to mention this gold because Liam Dunseith, who we had on the show, I think it was about end of last year, I can't remember which podcast, he was the Londoner who was coaching the Iranian Sevens team. He was contacted at the weekend because one of his players, and I hope I get his name right, Navib Azadzeba, I probably got that horribly wrong, but anyway, he was involved in a car crash and sadly has lost some of the fingers on one hand. Now, Liam Dunseith was obviously really upset for the gentleman back in Iran, but he contacted a couple of the England players, past and present, and asked, who were wingers as well, and asked them if they could send a message to try and lift this guy's spirits. And Ugo Monya and Jonathan Joseph both immediately sent messages to the Iranian player, and I thought that is, it shows what sport is all about. It shows what a great community rugby union is, and it was just a wonderful story, and I congratulate Liam for contacting those players and those two players for actually sending a message, and we wish the Iranian player a speedy recovery.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
See ya, we'll be back next week.